Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this hour of Focus, we will return to a subject that we have discussed many times over the years on this program, and that is the politics of the Middle East, very specifically the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. We have tried to present a number of guests with different perspectives over time, because we know that no single guest and no single show will please everyone who is listening. So we have tried to put on as many different kinds of people as possible. And to that end, this morning, in this hour, we'll be talking with journalist Ali Abu Nima, someone who has been when people request us to have people on the show. He has been a guest who has been frequently requested, a very long-standing listener request, to have him on this program, and we're pleased that he could be joining us this morning. He's writer and commentator on the Middle East and Arab-American affairs. He makes his home in Chicago. His articles have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, the LA Times, the Tribune, Chicago Tribune, Financial Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, and others, and he is also a frequent guest on local, national, international radio and television programs. He was born in the United States. He grew up in Europe. Both of his parents are originally from Palestine. He's a graduate of Princeton and also University of Chicago and travels often to the Middle East. He's a full-time researcher in social policy at the University of Chicago. And he is one of the founders of a website that's called the Electronic Intifada. So if you're interested in the Middle East, that would be one place that you could go to look at. And it has been around since the winter of 2001. So if you do have internet access, you can certainly go and look at it, look at the contributions that he has made and others have made to the website. And of course, this morning in this part of the program, we welcome questions and comments from people who are listening. We ask only that callers are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. But again, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ali Abu Nima, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I have a little bit of a sore throat and a cold, but I hope that won't stop my voice coming through.
Well, you sound just fine now. I hope it won't be too uncomfortable for you to be sitting there and talking with us for the hour.
No, not at all.
Very good. And we do appreciate you being with us because, as I say, I think that some people here in our community have been suggesting that we have you as a guest for a long, long time, and I'm glad that we could make it happen.
Me too.
Well, to begin with, a very, very basic question. Now, something that people have been talking about now for some weeks, ever since the passing of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. A lot of people said that it represents the opportunity for a new beginning in negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. And there has been, particularly immediately after his death, there's been a lot of speculation about who would come to the leadership of the Palestinian movement and what that would mean for the relationship here, again, as I say, between Palestinians and Israelis. Let me start. That's a big question. Obviously, we could talk for a long time about that, but let's start there. What is the significance of the passing of Mr. Arafat?
Well, it's significant in that he was someone who dominated the scene for decades, but a lot of this talk of a new dawn for peace or a window of opportunity is really, I think, misguided and wishful thinking or spin, which ignores the fundamentals. Mr. Arafat was somebody who had recognized Israel, had signed peace agreements with Israel, who'd won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing so, along with his Israeli partners. But that wasn't enough to bring peace, because the fundamental issues, the fundamental factors that make conflict between Israelis and Palestinians inevitable have not yet been addressed. There is still an Israeli occupation of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, millions of Palestinians living under Israeli military rule, their lives minutely controlled by the Israeli army. There are still hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers squatting illegally on Palestinian land, and millions of Palestinians live in exile, denied the right to return to their own country. So none of this has changed, and throughout the peace process, Israel has continued building the settlements on Palestinian land that make peace agreement impossible. And until Israel is willing to change those things, it doesn't really matter who you put in charge of the Palestinian Authority. It's not going to make a difference.
The position of the government of Israel, I think, or certainly of Mr. Sharon, was that Yasser Arafat was a roadblock to peace, and as long as he was around, he wasn't going to—that is, Mr. Sharon said he wasn't going to talk to Mr. Arafat. And then on the side of the Palestinians, they said, well, this is the man that we have selected to be our leader, and it seemed that if you take positions like that, then there's nowhere to go. Do you think that there was any way in which Yasser Arafat was a roadblock to the continuing talks about peace between Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, obviously, if you refuse to talk, as Israel has refused to talk for years, then you never know if there's a chance for peace. But talking by itself is not enough. I mean, we have this idea that, you know, if you have a peace process, everything will be fine. But, you know, here's a simple analogy I like to use. If you and I are going to negotiate over how to slice a pizza, and we need to, you know, decide where to cut the pizza before it gets cold, and while we're negotiating, I start grabbing the pizza and stuffing it down my throat as fast as I can. You're not just going to sit on the other side of the table and keep talking as if nothing is going on. And that's been the problem from the beginning, that Israel, throughout the peace process, has continued to build Jewish-only settlements on occupied Palestinian land. Israel is eating the pizza. And this is something they've been doing with the aid and comfort and encouragement of the U.S. government, which refuses to take a position that Israel must stop the settlement, must stop building settlements on Palestinian land. And as of August, according to the Israeli group Peace Now, there were no fewer than 4,000 individual housing units under construction for Jews only in occupied Palestinian land. This is the reality on the ground. It's not being talked about. And this is what stands in the way of peace. And when you have this level of violence from the Israeli side, because you can only build settlements using violence, I mean, come to Illinois and try it. Try taking away people's homes and forcing them out into the street without using coercion and violence. I don't think people would just willingly step aside. So there's immense violence from the Israeli occupation, which is generating Palestinian counter-violence. A lot of innocent people are dying, the vast majority of them Palestinians, but also some innocent Israelis. And as long as this continues, peace negotiations by themselves are meaningless. We have to step in and recognize that there's an enormous imbalance of power between the two sides. And in such a situation, without balancing that and coming in to put appropriate pressure on the Israelis and give appropriate support to the Palestinians, the negotiations are absolutely guaranteed to fail.
Tell me what you think about Mahmoud Abbas, who's the man who seems to be the likely candidate, the leading candidate to take over the leadership position that had been held by Mr. Arafat.
Well, Mahmoud Abbas is one of the founders of the PLO, along with Arafat. He's someone who has been presented in the Western press, particularly in the U.S., as a quote-unquote moderate. And he has been sort of, there's been this effort by the U.S., by Israel, by the EU, and by the Palestinian Authority to railroad him through as the successor to Yasser Arafat. But this is very troubling to a lot of Palestinians. First of all, although George Bush embraced Abbas is some kind of break from Yasser Arafat. Abbas is was one of Arafat's most loyal deputies. Abbas is seen by many Palestinians to be corrupt, to represent the same old god as Arafat. And there's no real debate, no real opportunity for Palestinians to decide. We've seen already, although there's supposed to be an election on January 9th, a great deal of intimidation, which prevents there being a real contest for the Palestinian leadership. And there seems to be an international consensus to railroad Mahmoud Abbas through and impose him on Palestinians despite the fact that they might not want that. So it's very, very troubling. And I think it's motivated by a desire to have a Palestinian leader who will be willing to sign agreements with Israel that give the Palestinians less than their minimum rights. And that's how many Palestinians are seeing it. And again, I think it's not going to work. There's going to be a lot of disappointed people who are going to wonder what went wrong.
One of the questions that about the elections, and I have to admit I'm a little bit confused because I've read so many different things, has to do with who all is actually going to participate, and particularly whether some of the more militant factions within the Palestinian movement, like Hamas, will actually take part, whether they'll field candidates, secondly, whether they will even participate at all. Is this something that is now dividing the Palestinian movement to the point where you have to question the very meaning of the election?
I think you do. I mean, I certainly welcome elections. I want elections. I've been demanding elections for years. But, you know, you point to a number of problems, and there are others. First of all, who gets to vote in these elections? You have to remember that the majority of Palestinians, or at least half, let's say, live exiled outside Palestine in refugee camps here in the United States, people like myself and my parents who are not allowed to freely return to our homes. Even though we have family living in the West Bank, we don't have the right to travel there freely. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who live in refugee camps around the region are not being given a vote. They ought to be given a vote. We saw in the Afghan election that the United States holds that up as an example, that 750,000 Afghan refugees in Pakistan were entitled to vote in the Afghan election. Why aren't Palestinians being given a right to vote? Secondly, this election on January 9th is only for the president of the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority was created in the Oslo Accords. It's not a government. It doesn't have any real authority over the Palestinians living in the West Bank. I mean, we've seen already that Israel is favoring Mahmoud Abbas. They're allowing him to travel freely across the West Bank into the Gaza Strip to campaign, whereas other candidates like Mustafa Barghouti — now there are two Barghoutis in this campaign, I know it's confusing — there's Marwan Barghouti, who's in prison, mm-hmm. but there's Mustafa Barghouti, who's a very highly respected physician and very well known, is also running in the election. And just yesterday, he tried to travel to Hebron in order to campaign. He was detained and roughed up by the Israeli army. He wasn't allowed to travel there. He hasn't been allowed to travel to Gaza. Another Palestinian candidate, the Speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, has already pulled out of the election because he said Israel has made it impossible for him to travel and campaign. And all of this points to the real absurdity of the notion of holding free democratic elections under a belligerent foreign military occupation. Imagine if we tried to have normal democratic life in this country with a foreign army in our streets shooting at us, demolishing our homes, shutting down election offices and party offices. You know, elections are about more than just showing up and voting. Before that, you have to have civil society, you have to have parties, you have to have campaigning, you have to build a machine. And nobody has a chance to do that in this election. The only people who have the apparatus are the ones who are already in power, so to speak. So in that sense, the election simply reconfirms the status quo and gives it a veneer of legitimacy. I know that complicates things because people like things to be simple, but if we want to understand why none of this is going to lead to any breakthroughs, then we need to grapple with those realities.
Hmm. Maybe let me ask you one further question, and then I have a couple of people who are on hold, and I promise I will get right to them. I just want to ask you a little bit further about one of the men that you just mentioned in passing, Marwan Barghouti, the man who is the Palestinian leader who is in jail. Early on, when people started talking about the elections for the leadership of the Palestinian Authority, there was some speculation that he might offer himself as a candidate or might stand, and then he said no, he wouldn't, and now just recently he has said again, yes, he would. Now he there's some question about whether he could actually run on the ticket of Fatah because Mahmoud Abbas has been selected to be the candidate, but I guess Mr. Barghouti could stand somehow as an independent candidate. He could run as an individual, and that could cause some serious divisions. What do you think about his candidacy?
Know. Oh, I think that, you know, I mean, Mahmoud, who picks Mahmoud Abbas? I mean, we don't have normal, as I mentioned, we don't have normal political life under foreign military occupation where you have party primaries, and Mahmoud Abbas emerged by some legitimate process as the candidate of the Fatah faction. This is all a very opaque process. Marwan Barghouti, who's seen by many Palestinians as having a lot more credibility and who's in Israeli prison, wanted to run. And, you know, why shouldn't he? If we're serious about democracy, let Palestinians choose. You know, opinion polls show that he is, to the extent that these polls can be trusted, because, it's very hard to conduct polling under Israeli occupation. But to the extent that they show anything, it's that he's more popular than Mahmoud Abbas, and yet there's been this international effort to keep him out of the election. Colin Powell chimed in against it, President Mubarak of Egypt. You know, it seems to a lot of Palestinians like this is all a stitch-up, that it's been decided in advance that Mahmoud Abbas is the man, and Palestinians are going to be asked to show up and endorse that, and they're not going to be given any other real choice. So if the elections are a sham, as so far there's every sign they will be, it's not going to lead to any peace breakthrough, and it's not going to improve the situation at all. We're simply fooling ourselves.
Let me again reintroduce our guest, and then we'll get to some callers. Ali Abu Nima is writer and commentator on Middle East and Arab-American affairs. He makes his home in Chicago. He was born in the United States, grew up in Europe, both of his parents originally from Palestine. He's contributed articles to many publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Jordan Times, Lebanon's Daily Star, and Haaretz, among others. And he frequently is interviewed on radio and television around the country and around the world. He is one of the founders of a website that's called the Electronic Intifada that came into being in the winter of 2001 with a lot of information and commentary on the Middle East. This, again, is a program that we're offering as a part of our continuing effort to try to promote some discussion of the Middle East and its politics from different perspectives. We certainly are open to suggestions about future guests, so that also is an opportunity. We'd like to try to involve listeners in the program, not just as callers, but they also help us shape the program, so we certainly would like to know what you think. We have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, and again, listeners will help us by trying to be brief, and we just ask that again so that we could accommodate as many different callers as possible. We'll start with someone listening this morning in Bloomington, Indiana, and our line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I want to contrast Palestinian refugees to Jewish refugees. When Israel was declared a state in 1948 by the United Nations, the Jews were expelled from Arab nations, often escaping with only the clothes on their back. And not only were those Jews expelled, but 5 Arab nations, as soon as the United Nations declared Israel a state, 5 Arab nations attacked Israel, 5-1. There was no way Israel could have won that war, but they did. And the Jews who had been expelled from Arab nations, they were welcomed into the victorious Israel, and they entered Israeli society and became productive citizens in a democratic nation. Now, in contrast, the Palestinian refugees from that 1948 war were put into refugee camps refused entrance into other Arab nations. Remember now, the Jews welcomed the Jewish refugees into Israel, but the Arab countries did not. They excluded Palestinian refugees from their Arab countries and put them in refugee camps, and they are still there. Those refugee camps are still there. Half a century later, Western countries have given billions of dollars to the Palestinians, to Arafat in particular, to pave roads, to make infrastructure, to create commerce, to create a normal life for the Palestinians, and never. But the money is never spent. The refugee camps are still maintained as refugee camps in squalid conditions. Billions of dollars are stolen.
I think the caller has made the point well, and I'd like to respond to him if I may.
Yeah. Yes. Go ahead.
You know, he's a good example of why it's so difficult to have this discussion, because there's so much mythology and falsehood and self-delusion and factual error. First of all, Israel was not declared by the United Nations and wasn't created by the United Nations.
It sure was.
Well, let me answer you, and, you know, any of the callers can go and check the facts I give you. On November 29th, 1947... the United Nations passed a resolution partitioning Palestine without the consent of its inhabitants into two states. Not automatically, but it gave UN trusteeship to the country, and the UN was supposed to prepare the country over several years to be divided into two states, one for Arabs and one for Jews. That process never happened. And what the UN partition plan did was it awarded more than half of Palestine to the Jewish minority, even though Jews were a third of the population and owned only 4% of the land. The UN, in its wisdom, at that time it was controlled by colonial powers who all had colonies of their own and didn't take the rights of indigenous people seriously, it gave 55% of Palestine to a third of the population. Now, Arab countries didn't invade Israel after the UN resolution. A war broke out.
Oh, baloney!
Caller, just a moment. I really want to say to the caller, please, and to other people who are calling, you know, we don't interrupt callers when they ask their question. We let people go on for a very long time, much, much more than any other talk show I've ever heard. So we really hope that you would extend the same courtesy to the guest and not interrupt him as he's trying to answer the question.
And let me try to be very brief about it, because it is a long topic. But in the war, which happened from November 29th, 1947, until May 15th, 1948, no Arab countries were involved whatsoever, no Arab armies were involved. But that was the period in which most Palestinians were forced out of their homes and villages and became refugees. And Israel was established on 78% of Palestine, and three-quarters of the indigenous population were expelled or forced to flee. That's when the Palestinians became refugees, and the Arab states didn't enter the war until May 15th, 1948, at which point their intervention made no difference to the outcome. People need to know these facts, but it doesn't really matter. If you leave your home because of a flood, if the Mississippi floods and you're forced to leave your home, you have a right to come back to your home. Nobody can move in and say, well, you left. And the condition of Palestinian refugees is separate from their rights. It's appalling that in many countries, including in the United States, in Canada, I was just there, as well as in many Arab countries, Palestinian refugees have been treated very poorly. But that doesn't take away their right to go back to their country. It's not simply a question of rehabilitation. And the question of Jewish refugees, I believe, and let me be absolutely clear, any Jewish person, any Jewish Arab who is expelled from an Arab country, who lost their property, has the right to go back to that country, has the right to go back to their Arab homeland and to recover all their property. And that's something I stand by for Palestinians and for Jewish refugees, without any difference between the two.
Can I ask you just to respond to another of the comments that the caller made? And it's a criticism that has been frequently made of the Palestinian leadership, and that is that at worst, at best, they're incompetent, and at worst, that they are corrupt, and that they have done a very poor job of trying to provide for the needs of the Palestinian people. And there is this issue about what has happened with what kind of aid there was provided And there were questions, for example, when Mr. Arafat died about certain monies and where they went. What's your thought about that particular criticism that has been
made? I have been writing and criticizing corruption in the Palestinian Authority for years and years when no one else in the international community was interested in it because they thought the Palestinian Authority was doing Israeli bidding, so everyone stayed silent about the corruption. Israel participated in corrupting the Palestinian Authority. Israel signed monopoly deals with certain figures in the Palestinian Authority, which harmed ordinary Palestinians by forcing them to buy basic commodities, fuel, consumer goods, cement from Israeli-controlled monopolies, who made corrupt deals with Palestinian Authority figures. You have the issue of corruption which cuts across the region. You have massive corruption in Israel. Every day brings new scandals. Ariel Sharon and his sons have been personally implicated in enormous corruption. You have Israel, which has been named by many international bodies as a world center in money laundering, in the Russian mafia, in trafficking of women. Israel is the country that supplies the largest number of tablets of the illegal drug ecstasy to teenagers in the United States. And I hear very little discussion of the massive corruption in Israel. But I'm very much in favor of fighting corruption, whether it's corruption among Palestinians or Israelis. And I've been very, very critical of Palestinian Authority corruption and will continue to be.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. If you didn't hear in the previous caller's remarks, the 1948, it wasn't Israel wasn't supposed to win, but it did, and that's because he's a Christian fundamentalist, and he believes that Christian Zionist, basically, he believes that it was divine intervention, I suppose. But what I wanted to ask about was go back to Marwan Barghouti. Lest he be called a flip-flopper for first saying he wasn't in, and then he was in, it seems to me that I haven't heard any commentators suggest that what happened in the interim was Hamas said it wouldn't participate, and that it becomes more of an internal inside of Fatah kind of thing. So I think that's what probably persuaded him to change his mind on that.
I don't know. I mean, he's been under intense pressure from world leaders. All this pressure on one man who's in an Israeli prison cell, it has got to be really intense. He's being called, disloyal by his own people who ought to be standing with him. So, I can't imagine the sort of pressure he's under after the ordeal he's been through in the past few years. So, I think anyone would be in that situation. I think he's still under intense pressure, and I wouldn't be surprised if he pulled out again. But here's the thing. Anyone who is serious about democracy, who really thinks that Palestinians ought to have a choice, ought to support him being a candidate. Let people decide.
But I wanted you to talk about Hamas a little bit in that one thing that also is not very well commented on is the fact that Israel aided Hamas when it was trying to play off the secular PLO at the time, so that it's like U.S. collaboration with Al Qaeda in some peculiar way has sort of a congruity, and that it's kind of blowback in some ways. I don't know if you have.
That's right. And Hamas, Hamas is a major political movement which has different trends in it. There's a very hardline trend that believes in fighting Israel, using almost any tactics, hitting back at Israel, even by hitting Israeli civilians, as we've seen over the past few years. And there's been also a very pragmatic faction within Hamas that has, over the years, begun to move against attacks on Israeli civilians, that has talked about, accepting any kind of settlement that is ends the occupation and at the same time fits in with a sort of a Palestinian national consensus. And here's the interesting thing, is that Israel assassinated those people in Hamas, the more moderate wing. They assassinated the more moderate leaders in Hamas many years before they hit the more extreme hardliners. And many Palestinians felt that this is because, really, Israel needs Hamas. They need to have this foil in order to say, look, there's no one to talk to. But Hamas isn't taking part in the election because they feel that this is what they say, that they don't recognize the situation created by the Oslo Accords, in which there's a Palestinian authority that has no real authority or sovereignty, and they don't want to give it legitimacy by participating in the elections. That's been their line from the beginning, and they haven't changed it yet.
If I might have one more comment.
Sure.
In Chicago, I'm absolutely annoyed that I hadn't heard anything about this trial where the and it ties into Hamas, because I think one of the things that the Holy Land Association and these two other groups are accused of is sending material aid, and some of it went to Hamas. And I would like for you to comment on, I see on your website you don't have anything up on that as yet, at least I didn't find it as yet.
Well, to tell you the truth, I personally haven't been following that trial closely, because to me it's nothing new. I mean, to me, it, you know, people ought to be able to go to the courts and get justice. But I think of the number of Palestinian Americans who have been killed by the Israeli army, who've had their homes demolished, who have had their children killed, who've had their right to education denied. And all of this is with the material support of the U.S. government, which pays for the occupation. Israel's occupation would collapse without our financial, economic, military, and diplomatic support. And there's nowhere for those Palestinian-American families to go to get justice. So I'm very skeptical of this kind of decontextualized trial. I don't support killing civilians. I'm against it. I'm absolutely opposed to such violence. Let me be clear about that. Regardless of the perpetrators, regardless of the victims. But I think of, if you read in the Israeli paper Haaretz, and there's a story today, I think we have it up on our site too, about a Palestinian child who was shot. He was working in the fields with his family, and he was shot by Israeli soldiers basically for fun while they were training. There was a 13-year-old girl, Iman Elhams, who was executed by an Israeli soldier in October, and that's become a big issue in Israel. But these are very rare cases that see the light of day. Over the past 4 years, there have been nearly 600 Palestinian children killed by the Israeli army, and almost none of them are investigated. And when they are investigated, the Israeli army investigates itself and clears itself. And unfortunately, our courts aren't open to any of these people to get justice, to get awards or civil damages. So I'm very, very skeptical of this kind of one-sided justice.
Let me again thank the caller. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus. We have others. I should introduce once again our guest. Ali Abu Nima is writer and commentator on the Middle East and Arab American affairs, makes his home in Chicago. One of the founders of the website, The Electronic Intifada, has also contributed articles to many different publications, New York Times, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, as well as the Jordan Times, the Lebanon Daily Star, and Haaretz. He's a frequent guest on local, national, international radio and television. Joining us this morning by telephone from Chicago. Questions and comments are certainly welcome. We'll try to get in as many people as we can. And again, this is part of a continuing effort of trying to promote some discussion of this issue from different perspectives, and we are certainly open to suggestions from listeners about other guests that we might have on the show. Let us go next to the next caller in line over in Belgium near Danville, line number two. Hello.
Good morning. Unfortunately, the first caller shows the basic problem with this whole area of very strong feelings on both sides. But that's not really what I wanted to ask about or make comments about. A few weeks ago, Mr. Inge had two gentlemen on here who were from the Israeli side. And to my way of thinking, they seemed they were fairly Zionistic, but I can't say that for sure. But I asked them a question, and the question I'm going to ask you also is, probably the most horrendous thing about this conflict that I've seen in the recent past, or period as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that there was a young lady who had children who decided to strap on some plastic explosives and go blow up her enemy, who was in Israel, and kill Israelis too, along with herself. Now, the question I asked them, and they obviously put the entire blame on the Palestinian side of it, saying it was an honor killing, which I didn't quite take as fact. But the question I said is, what drives people to do this? What kind of horrid conditions must push a person to do that, a young mother to do that, leave children, leave family, and go perpetrate such a horrid act? Can you give me your side?
Well, you know, you talk to a lot of people today who support the Israeli government, and they say, well, the problem is Palestinian violence, suicide bombings, all of these things. And I agree, that's a major problem. The first such suicide bombing occurred in 1994. In other words, 100 years into the conflict. It took 100 years before any Palestinian thought of blowing himself up or herself up and taking some Israelis along too. And I think the level of violence and brutality that Palestinians have faced at the hands of Israel is little understood in the context we live in. Let me give you an example. The media are going around referring to a period of relative calm, that there's been a relative lull in violence and so on. In the month of October, that's the latest month for which I've compiled complete numbers, 165 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli army. More than half of them were unarmed civilians. 36 of them were children. That's more than one child every day. And if you were to scale that up to the U.S. population, that would be the equivalent of 100 children a day being killed by the Israeli army. And people don't really have a sense of the scale of the violence that in some cities like Rafah in the Gaza Strip, nobody expects to die a natural death. Death by violence at the hands of the Israeli army is so common. And people have no future. They're suffocated. That doesn't justify suicide bombing. And, you know, this is the trap we get into. If we ever try to explain this as anything more than evil incarnate, then we're accused of trying to justify it. Well, as a Palestinian, I can't imagine doing such a horrifying thing. But, you know, I do ask why it took 100 years of conflict before somebody did that. And how the Israelis have got to the point where they can so routinely kill Palestinians, kill Palestinian children, and feel that it's justified, feel that it's self-defense to go and demolish an entire neighborhood and leave old women, children, babies sitting on top of piles of rubble, people who have been made refugees once, twice, three times, four times already, that the Israelis feel this is justified. That baffles me as much as how any Palestinian could feel blowing up innocent Israelis is justified.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to another caller here, and that would be someone listening in Urbana and Line 3. Hello.
Yeah, corruption was mentioned earlier, and I was thinking it made me think of the very insidious corruption of history that's taken place in the West, and particularly in the U.S. And what brought it up to me was that I was reading a little bit of Herodotus's The Histories, which was written in the 400s B.C. And in my Penguin edition, when you look in the index, there are no entries for Israel at all, but there are 6 entries for Palestine. And yet, when I was watching this program on the History Channel on cable on Alexander the Great, and his exploits took place 100 years later after the Histories in the 300s B.C., on this program, when they showed him, they were trying to show his exploits in the area, they referred to that area as Israel, you know, and to my understanding, Israel didn't exist and that's why I'm addressing this question to you, because you would probably know, and I certainly don't, but I think Israel didn't really exist between the period of like 700 BC and 1948. So I thought I'd ask you, a Palestinian, what period of time had the area in question been known as Palestine and not Israel? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, I that's a good question, but I take a different approach to this. You know, I think it's clearly absurd to believe that Israel existed in ancient history as a modern nation state, you know, the way we think of states today. You know, the only thing we can say with certainty about Israel, Palestine, the Holy Land, whatever you want to call it, is that it is an area with an incredibly rich and diverse history. Palestinians themselves are very diverse. You have Palestinian Christians, Muslims, Palestinians of African origin, of Central Asian origin. Palestine was a refuge for many hundreds of years. Chechens who were expelled from Russia, who were persecuted by the Tsarist regime, came to Palestine. There are many Palestinians today who have Chechen blood and who are very proud of that. So there's Armenians, too, who escaped persecution, came to Palestine, came to Lebanon, found refuge in these countries. So these places have long traditions of diversity. Jews, too, prior to the Zionist movement, there was no one saw a contradiction between being Palestinian and being Jewish. There were Palestinians who were Christians, Jews, and Muslims. So when I think of my heritage of a Palestinian, as a Palestinian, I include all of that in my heritage. I believe that, you know, my ancestors very likely were Jewish. I mean, how would I know? You know, my family is Muslim, but before Islam, probably they were Jewish. So I consider the Jewish history of Palestine to be part of my history. And I reject anybody who comes along to make exclusivist claims. It's particularly people who come from Europe and who say to people who are born and raised there that we belong and you don't. That's absolutely unthinkable to me. I embrace all of the history of Palestine, and it really doesn't matter, in a way, what happened thousands of years ago. You have Zionists making these absurd claims that Zionists can come back, and, you know, they're often coming for the first time, but quote-unquote come back after 2,000 years, whereas Palestinians born there don't have a right to go back to the place they were born. I believe that we're dealing with a situation where you have at least two peoples in Palestine, and they all ought to have the same right to live there in peace, in security, and in equality. And that's something that's really missing from all of the discussion of peace process and negotiations. Basic human equality and dignity.
Let's go to another caller. This is Gibson City, and that's line number one.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I am just so happy to hear you talk and telling a different side of the story, which we don't hear in our media.
Thank you.
And I've been there three times, and I stayed a month in Hebron because I work with a peacemaker team there. And I am not an intellect. I am an ordinary citizen, but I guess it's my faith walk. I am a Mennonite. I am a pacifist. I do not believe in violence. And I think that that's how it's going to have to be, no violence on both sides. The one thing I want to say is people don't realize, you said there are settlers there illegally. Not only there are they there illegally, but they carry around M16s, which I've seen with my own eyes. And when you first see it, it horrifies you. It'd be like somebody walking around in the United States able to carry M16s and then deciding who they're going to kill. And then also I want to say that being there, I've also read the book Blood Brothers by Father Elisha Kaur. And I got a chance to meet him, but he's a Malachite priest, and he believes in peace, and he's up in Abilene. And I would suggest that would be a book somebody would want to read, somebody that is not a very intellectual, that doesn't want to read something really intellectual. It's a very good story about how his family, he called his father a peacemaker because he lived along, they worked and lived with Jews, and they got along just fine until after 1948. Also, there is a book out about the children, Who Will Save the Children? And I don't know if I have time to mention it, but the group that puts it out is Bethlehem, an Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, and LAW, the Palestinian Society for the Protection of Human Rights and Environment. And this book shows the inequality. I mean, I abhor any death of any children, but the death compared to Jewish children and Palestinian children is very shocking. And the human rights violations that are going on there, people, I don't think, have a clue, or most people don't. And I just want to thank you again. And the only other comment I want to say is everybody talked about Arafat. And, you know, Arafat, what, you know, that Arafat is gone. Well, there's other players in the game, too, including Sharon, who set off the second intifada by going to the Temple Mount. So I guess my slant on it is there's a lot of good Israeli peace activists and Palestinian peace activists that I've met and good Palestinian and Israeli people that are working for peace. And I also say that there's, I get upset about it, that there's nothing in our news media that tells about the good things that are going on. And, I just want to thank you. And like I said, there's a lot, I could say a lot more, but thank you.
All right, well.
And I'll hang up. Goodbye.
Well, I appreciate the comments. And you want to follow up on anything that the caller said?
Just to say I appreciate the comments very much, too. I share those feelings. And, you know, we try to fill in some of the holes in the mainstream media on our website, electronicintifada.net. So that's a good resource for many of the kinds of information that the caller mentioned that you don't get from the, you know, from the daily paper necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I hope people will use that resource too.
One of the things that frequently I think has come up when we have had these conversations in the past is callers saying, and clearly these were callers that identified with Israel, saying that they were concerned that they felt that the Palestinian side never really in a convincing way renounced violence and said that they accepted the existence of Israel. Do you feel that at least on that second point that the majority of Palestinians do indeed feel that way?
Well, you know, I mean, it's hard to know what to say to people who say that. In 1993, the PLO, headed by Yasser Arafat, signed the Oslo Accords and signed an agreement in which the Palestinians accepted, recognized Israel, accepted all UN resolutions which give Israel the right to live within secure boundaries. This is something that was witnessed by President Clinton and by the whole world. And Israel reciprocally, Israel has never recognized in any formal way that Palestinians have a right to freedom, to independence, to self-determination. On the contrary, Israel has rejected that notion in word and in deed by continuing to settle Palestinian land, to build these Jewish-only settlements on it. That's the clearest statement from Israel of its contempt for Palestinian rights. And Palestinians renounced violence, but nobody can renounce a right to defend themselves. Israel also renounced violence, but it continued to use violence to build the settlements. As I said, the occupation is a system of pervasive violence. You cannot have belligerent foreign military occupation without violence, because its rule, its foreign military rule, without consent of the people, and it can only be enforced with extreme systematic violence. If someone comes to my home and says, God gave me a right to throw you out of your house, I'm not going to take that. And I don't think there are many Americans who would take that. So it's very dishonest to talk about violence without talking about the violence of the occupation, and to say Israel committed to peaceful negotiations, but Israel decided to predetermine the outcome of negotiations with bulldozers and tanks and guns. And in that situation, you cannot but expect there to be counter-violence from Palestinians. Having said that, I think it's also important for people to know that the vast majority of Palestinian resistance to the occupation is nonviolent resistance. What do I mean by that? When Israel builds roadblocks to stop people getting to school, and yet children get to school, they go around the hills, over the hills, to get to school, walking miles, That's nonviolent resistance. When Israel digs up a road to stop a farmer getting to his fields and taking the olive harvest, but people get together and they get in the harvest, that's resistance. When the army demolishes a house and someone's neighbor takes them in and helps them to rebuild their home, that is nonviolent resistance. And just because we don't see it on the nightly news doesn't mean it isn't happening millions of times every day. So if we want to support nonviolence, we have to give recognition to how people are struggling and coping in these impossible conditions. I mean, you know, when there's a snowstorm in Chicago, we panic and everything shuts down. I don't think we can imagine the level of daily obstacles and humiliation that living under foreign military occupation means. We just don't have a frame of reference for it. That going to the supermarket, going down the street, is a life and death situation. Getting your children to school with tanks in the street is a life and death situation. I don't think we have a way to imagine it.
We're just about out of time, maybe in about a minute or less. Do you think that there is something that the United States can do to help? Obviously, some people feel that that all along here, the one country with the opportunity actually to do something constructive here is the United States.
Yes, there's a lot we can do. We have to demand that our government be fair, even-handed, that it do justice. We cannot be an honest broker and at the same time be bankrolling the occupation, bankrolling the settlements, and providing diplomatic cover to what the rest of the world recognizes as war crimes. We have to condemn violence fairly and equally. Condemn violence when Palestinians perpetrate it against Israeli civilians, but we also have to demand recognition of the far greater and more devastating violence that is happening every day from the Israelis to Palestinian civilians. We have to be fair and even-handed. Nobody should be pro-Palestinian. Nobody should be pro-Israeli. We have to be pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli, which means being fair and doing justice. I believe that's the American way, and I think if Americans knew what was going on, they would understand why we have to be just, because the blowback of our one-sided support for Israel is reflecting on all Americans and damaging the image and reputation of the United States all over the world. And right now, we can't afford that. Mm.
Well, there we will have to end. Again, for people who are interested in reading more on this issue, one place you can go is the website we've talked about here, Electronic Intifada. Our guest, Ali Abu Nima, one of the founders, and they're on the web at electronicintifada.net. Ali Abu Nima is a writer, commentator on Middle East and Arab American affairs. He makes his home in Chicago. Thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I want to say to people who are listening, we're open to suggestions and comments about this program and thoughts for others that we might do. So be in touch. Programming is made possible here by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue, downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast also made possible by grant from Horine's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in